Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Well, with no further ado, welcome back to the Millennial Dentist, everyone. We have a couple special guests, although depending on when we release this, Jeff, you may be like a regular, or you may
depending
be,
on what you do,
or you may be your first time. So we have Dr. Jeff Riggs, oral surgeon extraordinaire in the house. And then we have a special guest out of, where are you out of, Travis? You at California, West Coast, somewhere over there?
St. Louis, Missouri right now.
Yeah, so in the Midwest.
Pretty close.
So not the West Coast. So, Travis Hornsby, is that your last name?
Yeah, yep.
Nailed it. All right, introduce yourself.
Well, I used to be a bond trader in the Northeast, traded money for millionaires and billionaires, you know, and just kind of got bored with that. So I quit the job, traveled the world, met the love of my life, and she happened to owe an unbelievable amount of med school loans. And so I thought, well, gosh, if I'm going to marry this girl, I want to try to help her out and figure out a plan for this and figure out how to pay it back. And so that's how I became an expert in student loans, and was looking for something fun to do because I'd kind of retired from the whole bond trading world. And so I started this student loan business, just kind of like a part-time thing initially, and then released my student loan calculator that I'd built with some of the Excel skills from bond trading online, and it got hundreds of thousands of views, and people were asking me all these questions, and I said, oh my gosh, this is a big problem. And so gradually kind of gravitated to helping people where the problem was the worst. And dentists are the number one profession in America for student loans. So the number one clientele that I've got is dentists. So been posting all over Dental Town and making the rounds on the dental podcast. Awesome to be on the Millennial Dentist today. And there's just so much you can do when you owe $300,000 or $400,000 in dental school debt. You know, it's just so easy to save several thousands of dollars, you know?
So, I think this is becoming a really big issue and a really big topic, and it's driving a lot of the way dentistry is moving, the way we are looking for jobs, the way what the jobs we're taking. And so I think it's a really big issue that needs to have a lot of discussion. You were doing day trading stuff, and then you got into, so what caused you to make the transition? Just because your now wife, I guess, had all that debt?
Yeah, I mean, It's in terms of the transition. So I had actually just saved up a bunch of money. I was lucky to not have been too educated. You know, I was just a dumb guy with a bachelor's degree and just, you know, happened into this finance job. And so traded maybe about $10 billion of municipal bonds and just was kind of bored. You know, if you sit around, it kind of messes with your brain. And so I was just kind of looking for a challenge and just basically it helped out my fiance with her loans and started helping her friends. They started asking lots of questions. And then
where did you get your knowledge on student loans? Like
I mean, organically and in building models. So, building that loan spreadsheet, I had to understand everything cold to be able to actually put in all of the logic into the spreadsheet, you know? And so that's kind of that and also having to figure out all of the different pathways for her. So she made a lot of money because she is a attending physician, right? So she had to look at private refinancing. She was also working at a not-for-profit institution, so she had to look at public service loan forgiveness. And so I had to understand the rules on both. And because that public service thing was in the mix, I had to understand income-based repayment options. So I had to understand everything to figure out her own personal situation. And then, you know, starting to help people, I built out the spreadsheet, and that's kind of where it all came from there.
I think the best way to probably do this is to kind of go through some case examples and talk kind of just candidly about stuff. What are you seeing as the average student loan debt now for dentists graduating?
$360,000 is my average. So that's like of all the people that I talk to now. Obviously, I'm getting probably a little bit higher debt loads than that exists everywhere. Because got fewer Texas A&M folks contacting me and got a ton of NYU and USC and Pacific folks contacting me.
Yeah, the real expensive ones.
Yeah, but the worst is about $550. So if you're going to a Northeast or California dental school, you're probably going to come out with $550K, and that's if you're the class of 2016 or 2017. My projection for those folks for class of 2021 is more like 650. So it's the problem is really bad and it's getting worse. So that's for, you know, a really high cost of living type place that charges a bunch. Your typical, like, you know, UT Health Center or some place like that, I mean, probably about 250 to 350, right? Public schools, kind of in-state. And then, you know, so if you kind of average those two together, that's how I get to that 360 averaged out across a bunch of different people.
This might be the wrong episode for this, but have you looked into any explanation as to why it's so exponentially growing so fast when it comes to these schools?
That's a good question.
Yeah. So in 2006, they completely changed how they did loans. So I think I heard, listened to an earlier episode where Dr. Dan was talking about how he took out student loans at the exact wrong time when they went from like 2 or 3% to 6 or something. So what happened is you created this thing called the Grad Plus program. And everybody was saying, oh, this is great because we're going to have these Grad Plus loans. You can take out up to the full cost of attendance. So you no longer have to worry about getting access to funds to go to school. Well, the schools figure that out, right? So if you're a dental school dean sitting there and you're looking at how to balance your budget and you're looking at how to get your faculty raises and make yourself move up the rankings and all that and do more research, and you got this new federal program that will give you funds up to the cost of attendance, you're going to do that. So basically, a lot of these dental schools started raising the cost significantly, right, about that 2006 level. And then so they just basically started saying, okay, you know, 5, 6, 7% raises every year on tuition, and the government's guaranteed to cut the check. So because the folks just kind of sign their name to the dotted line, the PLUS loans carry a really massive interest rate. It's a margin above treasuries of, I believe it's 4.6 or something like that, percent above whatever the treasury rate is. So that produces an interest rate of somewhere between 7 and 8%. And there's like a 4% origination fee on top of it. So you had that happen. And you had the broader societal trend of people just raising tuition just because the return on education they thought was great, so they could charge it, you know. So schools that could charge because people were demanding the seats in greater number than the seats were available and unlimited supply of capital, those two things were the perfect storm. And that's why we have such a high cost of dental school, in my opinion.
Well, that's a good explanation. I appreciate that. Yeah, that really
I never would have thought that. It makes total sense when you said the capital too, how basically is if the students are always going to have access to money and they're going to keep getting the money, then let's just keep raising it until the money stops. And then, then they can bring the fee, you know, they can adjust based
off. Yeah, the pressure on educators, the last thing they're worried about now is the student getting money. Like, that's the last thing I have to worry about. I'll worry about my faculty.
Well, it's sad because then there, what's happening is it's producing the problem of all the people graduating with no wealth, the debt and whatnot. So where do you start with a client? Because what is ground zero when they call you and they've got $360,000 in debt, and they don't know what to do.
Yeah. So, I mean, typically somebody reads some of the free content I put out on studentloanplanner.com, and they're like, oh, that sounds a lot like me. And so they send me an email, Travis@studentloanplanner.com, and they're like, hey, I got $360K in debt. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm getting married. I got a couple kids. You know, I'm trying to buy a practice. I don't know what do I do? And so I gather up all their information. I have them actually fill out a questionnaire that I take all that data and I build a simulation of all the different pathways they could pay it back. So I want to see, you know, income-driven repayment options. I look at all three of them. If you're eligible for PSLF, public service loan forgiveness, I look at that. I look at private refinancing, and I use the knowledge that I've got of that market to kind of get an idea of what you could get if you refinanced. And I want to see what would it look like if you did that today or in the future. And I take all those numbers, I boil them down, basically figure out what's the best way you can save money. And
so are you acting in some sort of advisory role too, or how do you skirt that line of like, I mean, are you acting like that? Or are you telling this is the best option, or are you just providing kind of all the information and saying do what you want with it?
It's both. I mean, so I just charge a flat fee for the consult, and that's $199 for individuals and $299 for couples through the end of August. And then I'm probably raising the rates just because luckily I've had a lot of people demanding my time. So it's basically the idea would be that I would give them the best route no matter what that is, you know. So I do kind of view myself in an advisory type role. Student loans is kind of like the Wild West right now. There's no regulation. There's all kinds of scam operations out there. So there's no such thing as a fiduciary responsibility like you'd find in the financial advisory world. There's a bunch of regulations, but that's kind of like the way I want to operate. So that's the idea, is just charge the flat fee and find the best route to repay it. And sometimes I find that somebody's kind of doing a pretty good job and maybe just adjust some tweaks around the edges. And then sometimes I find that people are just doing something totally wrong that they could save, $80,000 fixing. So I've gotten both of those calls probably more skewed towards the $80,000 to fix.
Jeff, you want to share your kind of experience and whatnot a little bit? And I think that'll drive some good questions.
Yeah. So I graduated high school in 95, started undergrad in 95, and then carried loans until I graduated residency in 2012. Mm. So it's 17 years of borrowing and accruing interest. And then from there, so I paid as much as I could, and my minimum payment right now is like $4,500 a month. It took me a couple of years to get down to what I actually borrowed.
Yeah.
Like wow. I accrued that much interest. And I'm not in the million dollar range, but I ended up with a little over $500,000 I had to pay back. And I graduated dental school in 2006. So that's kind of funny that I just missed that.
Yeah.
That nightmare.
More money.
of craziness. But I've gone to, I'm still trying to figure out this whole being adult thing and financial advisors and stuff. And I've gone to a dozen financial advisors and every single one of them has said, oh, your interest rates aren't bad. Just stick with it. I was able to refinance my majority of my Sallie Mae student loans at less than 3% back in like 2005. Awesome. And then I have almost equally private and government-backed loans that equal amounts. And the difference in the payments are phenomenal. One's roughly $1,100 a month. The other one's roughly $3,000 a month. And it's the same amount of money.
Wow. Is the lower one like a super low interest rate extended type thing? Or what? Yep. Is that the federal one?
Exactly. Yeah, it's extended over like, I think, 30 years at 2.8% or something like that.
Yeah. So that's a good one to just kind of kick the can down the road on. Mm-hmm. What does the interest rate portfolio look like? Like, what are the ranges?
6 to 8%, and half of those are fixed and half of those are variable.
Huh. Six to 8% on the stuff that you're paying $3,300 a month on, or?
Yeah, I have 8 different loan providers.
Wow.
That makes sense. Like ACS and AES and Texas Higher Education and Texas something else and Discover and Citizen.
All these
different loan providers. Nelnet, I think, is who bought Sallie Mae. So I have Nelnet on one side too. So within that range, some are fixed at a certain rate and some are variable.
Yeah. Well, that's a classic case. So if I took a look at Jeff's different loans, I would guess that within the federal loans, there's a split between two different loan programs. There's probably something called FFEL loans on there, and there's probably direct loans if you took out anything after 2010. So the direct loans are eligible for something called repay, which probably doesn't benefit you because the total, that's relative to all the debt you have on the federal system relative to your income. So if that debt to income ratio is around 1 to 1 or below, then those income driven payments don't really help you at all. The interest rate subsidy programs don't really help you at all. The only thing you can do is refinance to try to get a better interest rate. So
say that again. So I'm sorry, the 1 to 1, explain that to me again with the income to just total student loan debt, correct?
Yeah, sure. So say like hypothetical, right? Say you made $300,000 a year, you had $600,000 in student loans for kicks. And say half of that was private debt. So $300,000 was private debt and $300,000 was federal. Because that federal debt divided by your income ratio is 1, then there's no benefit to doing any of the income-driven type plans. So all you're going to do is just kind of spin your wheels, charge yourself 6 to 8%, pay the government more, profit than they really need. and it's not really helping you any. So in your situation, it kind of sounds like, you would need to really look at getting a better deal than 6 to 8. I mean, that's way too high for, someone who's, doing oral surgery is way too high. I would say that the best deal you probably get with a 5-year right now would be a fixed rate of 3.37. So that's for a 5-year. So that'd require a kind of hefty payment. For a 10-year, probably the best you're looking at is a 4.5. So that's, still better than 6 to 8. If you are an ADA member, I've got this deal with Laurel Road where you can get another 0.25% off their best rates. So the lowest 10-year if you're an ADA member is, I think, about 4.25. And that's a 10-year fixed rate.
Who's doing the most refinancing? I mean, obviously you hear about SoFi and DRB. Are those the two big ones, or are there other companies that are doing them? Or?
Yeah, I'd say Common Bond has actually shown up a lot more lately. And also LFI is a new company. It's an affiliate of Southeastern Bank. And I'm finding some surprisingly good deals with them. Just got a great deal for a dentist in Minnesota the other day that had a bunch of debt, but a bunch of income too. And it just made sense to refinance. And he was kind of like, I was shocked too that he got such a good deal from them. And, you know, so the refinancing landscape is always changing. And that people are always trying to do different deals and try to beat each other and try to do kind of different promotions. And so the way I look at it is my goal is to stay on top of that and kind of be an expert in that market so that if it makes sense to refinance, I'm going to find you the best deal no matter where it is. Most people, I'll tell you the way that most dentists refinance, it's kind of the way that most people decide on their mortgage or buy a car. You know, you're sitting at home watching the game and some ad comes on and it says, refinance your loans with so-and-so, you know? And so you go visit the website and you just do a little application and they give you something that looks decent. And you're like, all right. And so you just click the button. And I've seen people leave, you know, 0.5% or 1% lower interest rate on the table doing that. And, you know, on 400 grand, you know, you're talking $2,000 to $4,000 in interest potentially a year that you're kind of just giving to somebody else's profit balance sheet, you know? It's something you gotta look at different places. You gotta look at least, you know, I'd say three at least, you know, just to make sure you're getting the best deal. There's just too many places out there you can shop for good rates these days.
That's good to know.
So one of the big complaints I get for new graduates or their fear with the refinancing is they're like, well, what then all of a sudden if I refinance these companies, then my payments aren't going to be like I can't default on them or I can't be forgiven for them. And they have this idea that they're like, you know, like that holds over their head. I think that's a silly way to think about it. What are y'all's thoughts on that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, isn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong, but like a Sallie Mae are the only ones that are strictly.
I'm gonna have to ask our student loan expert
ask him, right? Like if it's I'm answering out of turn, but I just thought if I can't really default on them except for those, like someone down the line attached to me would still be responsible for the loans.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, no student debt is defaultable, if that's a word. I don't know if it is, but you know,
maybe
you can't,
forgivable is the right word. I think they're going to be
forgivable is the right word. Yeah, so I've got people that have defaulted on student debt before, and it's not pretty. I mean, you know, people think that student debt's like credit card debt, where if you just try to, you know, stop paying it, maybe they'll offer to settle for 30 cents on the dollar. And that's not true. Student loans are got these special protections where they're not eligible for bankruptcy, so they can come after your tax refund. They can garnish your wages. The best settlement I've ever seen is like 90 or 95 cents on the dollar of what you owe. So, you know, the only thing you'll accomplish not paying your student debt is trashing your credit and still owing them a bunch of money. But in terms of forgiveness, which is a thing, if you're working at a public service type job, you can get public service loan forgiveness. That just doesn't apply to very many dentists, though. I had a call with a dentist the other day who was eligible working at a place. It was a good candidate for it, but he was doing a great job and figured that, well, heck, I might as well just go buy my own practice and make double the money and just pay it off and own a dental practice, right? So you know, most dentists are not really, you know, candidates for that. Like, you know, the physicians, they all seem to work at not-for-profit hospitals. So that's a little difference there between the professions. But in terms of forgiveness, the real thing for forgiveness is like if your household debt to income ratio, and I'll just stop and pause for a moment, you know, debt to income ratio, right? So if you're making $150,000, that means you got more than $300,000 in student loans, right? And that's like at a household level. If that debt to income ratio is above 2, and it's going to be above 2 pretty much for the foreseeable future, then forgiveness is really your only option to go down for a good financial outcome. And the reason for that is think about what that would mean, right? So you're making $150,000 a year. Say you got $300,000 in student loans, or actually, let's say it's more like $400,000.
I feel like that's a very good example, though, because like, okay, you got a lot of students who they got $350,000 in debt, and then they're going to come out and make $120, you know, or they're going to take the guaranteed, you know, corporate salary right now for $120, $130. That seems to be a very popular theme. What is that setting them up like?
And that's mentioning the corporate thing because of terrified of student loan debt. That's a good
one. Exactly. Because I think that's what, because they want the guaranteed money, right? Like, I think that's one of the reasons that corporate's thriving right now is not because of any other reason other than a guaranteed check.
Yep. Yep. Well, people got to realize one thing. If you're doing corporate because of your student loans, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. Because
Coach Travis.
Yeah, there you go. There's a something you can take and cash into the bank.
Yeah, buddy. That's important.
But people got to know that. So you know, you look at balance sheet. You look at debt, and you're like, crap. I owe $400,000 because of what I taught my brain the past 4 years. I'm screwed. Right? It's psychology. So you say, okay, I can't afford to live with $400,000 in debt unless I go get a guaranteed job, because I'm scared of owning my own business because I'm going to go bankrupt and my family's going to be out in the streets and everybody's going to be mocking me because I was a dentist and I should be able to provide for my family. And so what happens is they go and the risk aversion goes way high and you take these corporate jobs. But here's the thing. If you've got $400,000, if you've started school after 2010, all of it's with the federal government. So you can pay a percentage of your income. So worst case scenario, you put it on something that allows you to pay little to nothing while you're getting set up in the practice. And if you look at practice default rates for practice loans, almost all of them get paid back. That means 99.9% of people end up with an asset after 10 years of taking it out because they own their dental practice outright and they're making more money than you would as an associate. So the idea that you would go be a corporate drone or work as an associate for, you know, Heartland Dental or, you know, Pacific or something else like that, it just doesn't make financial sense at all.
That's straight math. That's not like that's taking emotion out of it, is what you're saying.
Yeah,
like,
that's just math. That's the math working. That's the problem is because we're emotional creatures. You look at $400,000 and that causes a visceral reaction in your soul, right? I mean, you're just like, crud, I owe so much debt. I feel like I have a big income, but I'm screwed. How the heck am I going to afford $4,800 a month in payments?
Well, that's a little bit of, or sorry, I keep interrupting. I'm bad about that.
Jump in.
Well, as I said, that's my argument, the whole debt thing in the beginning, and to begin with, is that the reality is, as a dentist, okay, owning your own practice, you better start to get comfortable with somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million in debt all the time, you know, because you're going to be buying $100,000 machines. You're going to be, you know, buying expensive practices. Like and I'm not trying to compare student loan debt to practice debt and all that. Like, I get that there's differences and that sort of thing, but the idea of just the big number and learning to live with that, I think is, you know, in not a reckless way, but a comfortable way is a good thing to get to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let me just throw out what that 120 K person would do with $400,000. If they're going to stay a corporate person for their entire career, what you do is you get on something like PayEarn or Repay. You pay 10% of your discretionary income over 20 to 25 years. Maybe you pay like $150,000 in total cash outlay. Your balance grows from $400,000 to maybe it grows to $600,000 because if you're staying on one of these programs, they give you interest subsidies. So then you pay 40% of $600,000 in 20 to 25 years. So you're paying $240,000 all in a lump sum. And then if you adjust for that for inflation, you're talking about a total cost of dental school of maybe like $250,000 to $350,000 on $400,000 borrowed. You know, so like there's this backdoor way to optimize that. And you can do all kinds of stuff that I show people how to do with like income minimization and putting money away for the tax penalty to plan for that. And so no matter how ugly it is, no matter how bad it is, you can always save money with dental school loans because there's just such big numbers involved. And that's if somebody's going to go down that route. If they're eventually going to go the private refinancing route, then I want to set them up to have as small of a balance as possible at the point where we're going to refinance. So I'm going to say, okay, 3 years from now, you're going to refinance. In the meantime, let's get some interest subsidies by basically using all these loopholes with government plans to figure out exactly how to maximize those. And then you can go and refinance and get a lower interest rate and pay it back. But I have to give congratulations to Jeff though, because the typical OMFS I'm talking to has got like $650 or $700. So
really,
yeah, that's more recent, you know. But that's you're below average probably by about $150,000.
That's great.
You're like, oh, it makes you feel better right now.
you're only $500,000. You know,
I was Indiana. I mean, it was both state schools. I got in-state tuition for medical school, and then in state for dental school. I'm still that much in debt. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy.
No,
go ahead.
I was just saying another thing that people kind of overlook is dentists and, you know, can often qualify for low down payment mortgages probably. And if you can't qualify for just a straight up doctor loan, you can get like a, you know, FHA loan, but probably would go for the doc loan if you can get one. And mortgage debt
from that a couple times, the doc loan.
Yeah,
that's helped out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, mortgage debt's tax deductible, right? Student debt is not tax deductible. So a common mistake that I see that I correct, somebody's saving up for a 20% down payment because, you know, grandma taught them that they only want to do a conventional mortgage or else they have no business buying a house, right? But if you're going to be a dentist in a community, you're trying to build a practice, all that stuff, you're going to be there for five years at least, probably more like 10, you know, so you don't have to really worry about trying to sell your house because you're going to be there anyway, you know. And so the idea is maybe you do a low or no down payment mortgage to have more mortgage debt, which is tax deductible, which allows you to target more towards the student debt instead of kind of leaving it in a bank account earning 0.5% taxable interest for 5 years while you're trying to get the down payment of 80K saved up for your dream house, you know. So that's another big thing. A lot of people make that mistake.
Well, and I can make an argument too. I think that, you know, ultimately a big problem we have, especially as millennials, is as we graduate and we want to go buy a new car or buy a motorcycle or buy the dream house. And so we get in a habit of like, okay, not only do we have a lot of debt, we have a lot of things stacked up against us from the interest rates to the amount of the tuition costs. And so the worst thing we can do is go, you know, start living like we're this awesome doctor that's figured it all out and whatnot. And so I think, you know, you can do all these things right, but if you're not doing that right, if you're not trying to save and you know, I'm a big white coat investor fan. I'm sure you've seen his stuff and whatnot. He always says live like a resident or live like, you know, you're a new graduate basically. For those first couple of years, it can set you up so much better for the future. I did one of the doctor's loan. The only negative of the doctor's loan is now I'm 2 years in and I only have $18,000 in equity in my house. Yeah. And so we want to do this big renovation but I have no equity really to do a home equity line of credit. So I'm going to most likely have to get a construction loan, which kind of stinks, but that's the only negative.
That's good. Now you have an excuse why you can't renovate the kitchen or the bathroom.
That's not going to work for the wife, unfortunately. Well, that's great.
I mean, you know, the thing is like, old dentists, I mean, older dentists, I should say. I shouldn't call them old dentists. I mean, they got to give millennial dentists props because back in 25 years ago, you know, you could go sign your name, get 50K, 60K of dental school loans. And you know, PPOs hadn't ravaged the profession as badly quite yet. So, you know, you're pulling in maybe 230, 240K average income, you know, with your 50, 60K dental school loans. You know, you could afford, a couple big mistakes. You could afford a couple silly brand new, you know, Lexus or Mercedes purchases you probably shouldn't have made that you then turn around and sell, you know, because you didn't realize how expensive they were like 2 years later and take, you know, 30K depreciation. You know, you could afford maybe a divorce, probably not two, but, you know, I mean, you could afford some major problems and mistakes in life and still come out fine and still come out with a big chunk of money in the bank and good investment portfolio and all that. But millennial dentists are being hit from all sides. I mean, it's like the corporate thing, the PPO thing. If you are trying to own a practice, the outrageous student debt. I mean, I'm real concerned that I'm going to go, my dentist told me that I grind my teeth. So I'm concerned that I'm going to need, you know, 10K of dental work in 25 years and I'm not going to have a dentist to go to, you know. I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but, you know, I mean, it's that level of risk. I mean, it's, you know, what, who should be a dentist anymore? I mean, I've run the numbers and, you know, unless you're going to like Texas A&M paying 160K for 4 years, man, the numbers just don't kind of work out. You should have gone and been some sort of corporate, person for, you know, your career and retired in your mid 50s, you know, I wonder what you guys think about that.
And I think dentistry is very polarizing right now. I think you have a lot of practices and dentists who are very successful. And then I think your practices that really struggle as we move forward. And I think a lot of that has to do with technology and embracing that and pushing your practice, because there's a lot of practices that are doing really well. And like because I always joke with the ADA's, you know, average income, whatever, it's like 100 grand or for a dentist. I'm like, well, like who's like, what are the terrible dentists doing? Like, you know, I mean, the average general dentist right now should be making at least 200 grand or, you know, I mean, that should be easy to do. And if that's the case and you are saving, well, then it all of a sudden looks a little prettier.
Well, it does, but where does the average dentist want to live? So I have this problem all the time. I talk to OMFS people that are making barely above 200K that live in New York City. I talk to orthodontists that are associating making about like 225K in like, you know, San Fran or New York all the time. I talk to generalists in DC that are working every other Saturday, making 110K working as an associate for corporate all the time. And so you look at where the dentists live.
Why are they there though? Like that to me is that's on them though, to a degree. Like I'm not saying that like
I think our cities have that way. I think Nashville's had that way.
Oh, I definitely agree.
I guess it's a popular place. People want to be here. That's what caused some problems probably with the accepting PPOs and things like that. Like, oh, we'll take this to be competitive. And then everybody has to take it to be competitive. And they just drove all the reimbursements down.
But that's a cost benefit thing. Like if you, okay, so then you say, yeah, if I want, like one of my buddies, he's living way out in a rural town and he's just raking it in, you know? And then he spends most of his weekends here in the city or whatever, and then drives back money through. And so I guess my point is though, is like, if you've got $400,000 in student debt, and you know, then yeah, you do need to think about whether you want to live in downtown New York or you want to live in San Francisco or, you know, LA or wherever it is. That's like, you know, maybe to me, that's not a good, if that's the goal at the end game, then you're right. It's not a financially good decision to be a dentist.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but you know, that's the issue. I mean, like most people, they want to live where they want to live, right?
Sure. That's a big millennial thing too. We're bad about that. We'd rather take less money.
Well, yeah. So I had a guy email me the other day, and a couple months ago, I guess, actually, and he said, I've got a $275,000 a year guaranteed associate job in middle of nowhere, Oklahoma. And there's a production bonus on top of that. And if you move there, the state of Oklahoma will give you like 20K a year for loan forgiveness, you know? Okay. But here's the problem. Sounds if you're like single, paradise. You're moving in the middle of nowhere. The biggest town is like, you know, 100 miles away and it's got 10,000 people, you know, and, you know, you're just basically working your butt off. People take kind of the non-thinking way out, which is just, okay, I went to dental school in this place. Like, I'm going to find a job within 100 miles of my dental school because it was fun going to dental school, right? And that's kind of coincidentally where the debt loads are the worst. And so that's where the people have the hardest time, right? But your Nashville's, Austin's, I mean, it's happening in the South too. Utah, why is Utah so saturated? It's because every Mormon dentist in the world wants to move their family back to Utah, you know? So you look around the different places in the country and most dentists are going to the places with a 500-to-1 population to dentist ratio. And there's still those 9,000-to-1, you know, counties out there in rural Iowa that Delta Dental will give you this big match for your student loans for that nobody wants to go to because they're single and they're hoping to meet somebody, you know? But there's a couple success stories. I talked to a dentist who had moved to random rural Texas and was pulling in like 350K doing mostly fee for service because he had no dentist in like 20 miles near him. And so then you don't have
was
to take
Waco
PPOs, right? What now?
Was it Waco or Midland? One of those places.
I mean, you know, I think he was, you know, like an exurb of one of the big cities, probably like 150 miles away from like a, you know, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio kind of place. But, you know, there's still places out there where you can kill it, but you got to make sacrifices. And us millennials, we like our avocado toast, right? We don't want to make sacrifices.
Yeah, we don't. But that's part of the problem though, too, because you know, you can't move to this big city, you know, take the fancy job where, you know, whatever, and then go buy the car and then eat out every night and, you know, buy $15 drinks. I mean, it just doesn't, at some point that mindset's you're going to get what you asked for a little bit. So, there has to be some give and take is, I guess, my point.
Yeah. But there's a lot of people being responsible too, that are in terrible shape. I mean, you know, like the typical person is not a business genius, right? Or even like really good at business. Like most people that go to dental school, like they like helping people, like they want to do dentistry. You know, they're real good at kind of nuts and bolts of things. But if you asked them to hire, you know, a $20,000 consultant to come show them how to, you know, increase the production of their practice 20%, that gives them pause. That scares them. They don't want to do that, you know? And so that's why your typical practice is like 500, 600,000 in production. And, you know, net income is probably 150 to 200. because they're not able to make that next step. They don't want to make that next step because it's kind of scary to do. But yeah, I mean, you got to go out and you got to buy the $800,000 practice, not the $500,000 practice, if you've got all that student debt. You know, you got to work hard. And you know, I can tell you what the path to, you know, being financially independent in your 40s looks like for dentistry. You just have to decide if you wanted to do it or not. And if you don't, then, you know, like I said, we can save you money doing more of like the income driven repayment, going for loan forgiveness, that kind of thing.
So do you have any more questions about the loans before I transition this a little bit? Cause I have...
No, I think have you mentioned is, I'm just curious if you've seen this or not. You mentioned buying a practice. You just mentioned again. Do you see that still as a benefit beyond student loans? Like these practices are still being sold, or people are just saying, no, I'll buy my own building, start my own practice.
Yeah. So you're saying buying a practice versus building one? Yeah. The easy, no risk approach is just buying the practice. That's, you know, cause you're taking a competitor out of the market in the region you're moving to. It's already got the staff, it's already got the cash flow. As long as you don't, you know, go cuss out all the patients on the first day, you'll keep a high percentage of them. that's the easiest way to do it. You know, if you are more of a low risk kind of person, then I would suggest that route. If you are the kind of person that loves to be an entrepreneur and wants to dig into the weeds and make the hiring and firing decisions, and you know, that doesn't scare you at all, and you've like loved the idea of being a CEO of your own small business, and you know, of just really taking a big risk, then I think that starting your own is pretty straightforward, to be honest, too. I think you'd go and you'd hire a great demographics firm to do an analysis. I think you'd want to know exactly why you're starting in a specific area that you are. I'd probably try to own my own building. Maybe, you know, if I was going to take a big risk, I'd probably want to go somewhere where real estate was real dirt cheap. I wouldn't do it in a place like a San Fran or New York where real estate costs you an arm and a leg. You know, I'd want to own my own building in some random out of the way, nowhere place where it's dirt cheap. And then, yeah, I'd build my own practice and, you know, take out a $200,000 or $300,000 loan instead of a $700,000 or $800,000 loan. And I also wouldn't pay for my own production. So if I'm associating somewhere and I've got an old dentist that wants me to buy him out, I'm going to make sure that we got some sort of purchase agreement in place before I go start building his practice for him and keeping the numbers high, because then he's going to charge me for production that I'm producing myself. So I'm kind of like, yeah, I'm buying stuff for myself. So that's not smart. So yeah, I mean, I'd say, you know thyself. If you're the kind of person that, you know, would rather not put a ton of money in the stock market, and you know, you like sleeping easy at night, and you don't like the idea of, you know, taking big chances, and yeah, go buy a practice. And if you the kind of person that's real entrepreneurial and love risk, then yeah, go start one, because that's going to have the higher risk reward.
Couple thoughts on that. You know, I think it's getting very, very hard to do that, and not. I think everything you mentioned is dead on, but I just think the dentistry side of it is really, really hard to do that, just because I think
which
there's
one.
To start your own from scratch, because I personally think, because I am a very much go-getter, running, trying to do it all today, you know, have no problem with the managerial stuff. And I have been blown away with how difficult it is to figure out the dentistry, figure out the staff, team, figure out the business, figure out all that. And so I think that unless you just are heck bent and can't find an associateship or something like that, I just feel like there's so many benefits to getting some sort of mentorship as an associate that I really, really, you know, I don't know if a partnership's, you know, being in one is a total viable option for most people, but you know, some sort of, you know, year to year kind of like transitional, or even buying out, because even if you just buy them outright, a team can be very helpful. I mean, even having a team that knows all the patients, you know, and knows how to help you handle situations. I mean, there's so many intangibles that's my two cents on that a little bit.
Yeah, you got to associate some. I think associating for a year or two is certainly a very good
idea.
Yeah,
even if you do that corporate, yeah. I don't care. You know, I don't care where you do it. You know, I think that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would say if you're gonna do a startup, do that kind of mentorship arrangement for a year or two, and then if you're gonna do it, make sure it's in a place that's got that population to dentist ratio. I'd say over 3,000. Because then you can afford a lot more margin for error. You know, there's counties, like I said, in Iowa that've got that 9,000-to-1 ratio, which is just absurdly high. You could go open a building, open a practice there, and, you know, people are going to go to you even if you almost kill them. I mean, because they need dentists, and they don't have any options, and so they're gonna, they can drive for an hour to go to, Des Moines, or they can go to you. So they're gonna do that. So yeah, I mean, I'd say, lots of guardrails around the startup, probably not the right option for 90% of people, probably buying is. But yeah, I mean, I've seen people do it that have been very successful. So,
sure. Yeah. I want to kind of talk about cash. We don't have too much time left, but I want to talk about cash flow a little bit. How do you advise people with, as far as the debt goes? And a lot of this probably has to do with risk on just the importance of cash flow and with the practice. And I kind of wanted to just get your thoughts on that a little bit. And Jeff, your thoughts too, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I tell folks that banks always tell you have to have, $100 million of money in the bank before they're going to give you a practice loan. And that's just not true. Generally speaking, they'll ask for like 3% liquidity for the practice purchase price. So if you've got $20,000 in the bank, great. That probably takes care of most of your liquidity need for a practice purchase. I've seen people that have been holding like $80,000 in the bank just because they want to buy a practice. And that's not really necessary, I don't think. There might be one or two banks that want that, but generally speaking, I don't think that's that important. But I would say, starting with getting that, $10,000 to $20,000 emergency fund / liquidity fund set up is probably first priority when you get out of school, just to make sure you're protected against making bad decisions with credit cards and things like that. Getting on the right repayment plan immediately is very important for interest rate subsidies. Generally speaking, I can help somebody cut their interest rate in half by getting them on the right repayment plan with the government while their income shows zero from the previous year. So that's important. And then getting just like a match for your 401k, do that, but probably don't contribute way more than that if you've got a buttload of student debt that you need to pay off. Student debt, the way to think about it versus investing, it's a guaranteed return, and it's a guaranteed return that's above the treasury bond return by, a percent or two in terms of the annualized investment, amount that you're looking at. But it's probably not quite as good long term as investing in the stock market. But what I'd say to that is if you had a 4% CD that you could go down and lock in risk-free, tax-free at the bank, basically everybody would want to do that, And that's basically what you're looking at with your student loans. And that's the primary benefits of paying off the student loans. It's psychological. People are, it causes all kinds of stress. I've had so many dentists, one dentist even told me, she was like, I don't think I can have kids because this stresses me out too badly. Like I'm freaking out about this and I don't know how I'm going to do it. And so that's the damage it causes your just mentality about being trapped and feeling trapped. That's why you want to pay it off in addition to the money savings.
Thing that I disagree with you a little bit on that point is the from the emotional standpoint, I think it works in the reverse too, because I see that, and this goes back to the point that I think people need to learn to be more comfortable with the debt, because if you've got that much debt, okay, and you don't, and you pay down, and don't invest anything, okay, then what happens when you get done? I think psychologically, when people get done paying down the student debt, they don't attack their retirement like they attacked the debt. That makes sense? All of a sudden, the emotional, psychological part switches, and so then they start eating out more, doing more. So I kind of think that from a psychological standpoint, it's better to not necessarily delay all your student loans or debt or whatever completely, but that taking advantage of taxable, the tax advantage accounts in retirement that we have is a really, really good thing to do, just because at the end of the day, if you get down to the end of the month and you've got, $150 or $1,000 student loan payment versus, going to on vacation, I don't know, doing whatever, you're probably going to not do it and you're going to make the payment. But if it gets down to the end of the month and you got $1,000 to like max out your, 401k versus doing that, I don't think that people make the same emotional decision. Do you all see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd say that, I'm kind of open to different interpretations. The thing about student debt that bothers me so much is it's totally different from mortgage debt and business debt. Because a mortgage or business debt, you can sell a business, you can sell a house, you can walk away from that, and it's because there's an asset that backs that value. So it's not really debt. It's like debt for business purposes, right? It's debt that's not something that necessarily like traps you. Whereas student debt, if you decide you want to go join the circus, which, no way any dentist would ever do that, right? But you know, with student loans, you're stuck. And so, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think it's important to invest. Like it, ideally, so I'd want somebody
that was.
To
I know
that was my argument.
Jeff and I have had this huge discussion about that, and that was his.
But you made it so much easier said than I did.
Yeah.
Like I can't join the circus. I have no option to join the circus because I'm tied to this debt.
And I guess my point to that was if ultimately, like that's a, I don't know, if you've gotten to this point, I don't know. It's just hard to baffle that is there that many people that want to walk away? That like, you know, that as soon as they pay off their loans, they're leaving?
It's just a psychological thing, like you said, people being tied to something and then doing... just not having the option to do anything else, the same as this woman who can't have children because she's tied to this debt.
That makes sense. So it's not, you're saying it's not a mathematical thing. It's a psychological thing though.
Yeah, it is. I think it absolutely is. Yeah.
And I think that makes sense. I think, like you said, I think he put it better than you did.
Much better.
We were also a couple cold beers and other things deep. So we had the discussion.
I did not explain it well at all.
I mean, no, but if you maxing your 401k is $1,500 a month, right? So that's $1,500 a month. Maybe you're making like $150K because you're maybe a higher earning associate. You're getting paid 30% of production. You're busting your butt. So
it's also saving you tax. Like that's helping.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So your take home maybe is like $10K or something after your 401k contribution. Maybe it's $9K or something like that. So maybe if you refinance your student loans for a 10-year payment, that's, you know, a $3,500 a month. Okay, great. You still got, you know, $5,500 a month you can spend on whatever you want. Well, that's a heck of a lot better than most people. I'm not saying that dentists should be most people because you work hard and you got a dental degree and did 4 years dental school. But I mean, perspective, right? I mean, I talk to people in a lot of different professions, and I'll tell you that, you know, certain professions out there, like being a veterinarian or chiropractor, it's like on the verge of predatory lending because they come out with $250K to $300K, which is not too much less than dentists, and they're making tops like $80K. Maybe some, you'll have that occasional, you know, a unicorn chiropractor is making like $200K. You know, that's like the top 1% of chiropractors. Same thing with veterinarians. So perspective wise,
not to just random. I was surprised by this because it's the opposite of us. Corporate veterinary medicine, like Banfield, you're considered a sellout, but you make more. You make like $150K. Private practice vets make like $40K-$50K.
I had no clue. I thought that.
I didn't either. The specialty group in Nashville makes more. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
It's because people, you know, vets go into medicine, you know, pet medicine. They want to help people, right? They want to help their patients, and they have good, you know, very giving hearts. And so a lot of times, I think a lot of them don't run their businesses like businesses, and Banfield really does. So I think that's why you see that in that field, but. But yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of the dental school debt, the biggest thing is get a plan. Like I talk to people that are like 5-6 years down the road, kind of like not thinking about it. And they've got, you know, $20K in credit card debt because they kind of just living above their means and they haven't really been doing anything with their dental school debt. And so it's grown and they're not getting any interest subsidies because they make too much, but their debt's still really high. Right. So, send me an email, Travis@studentloanplanner.com, and
And so you're do all this, basically it's $199 per person.
Yeah. It's going to go up probably to $249 by the end of August. But, if you reach out before then you get the current rate.
Maybe give it through August for these listeners. Cause this is probably not going to release till August.
Till the end of August, for millennial dentist listeners.
There you go. I really appreciate it. I think this, to me, I think that, and I didn't really know what to expect, but to me, that seems like a no brainer. Because
absolutely,
that's a lot. That's so cheap. Okay. That's dirt cheap for the information that people are going to get who have zero knowledge on this stuff. And who don't have, most of them don't have any interest on this stuff.
No, like as I've talked to, I don't know how many financial advisors, and they're really not clear on all this stuff. They're more focused on your retirement, like you're
your
talking
assets.
About. Yeah,
and well, that stuff. Them so, making the money, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you know
it's
why,
hard
right?
to find someone that knows this much about like you do.
Yeah, well, the financial advisors, the payment model, they get paid a 1% of assets under management, you know? So if I get paid 1% AUM and everything I invest, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to know everything in the world about investing and I might be an ethical good person, but I, you know, if I don't get paid to know about it, then I'm not going to know anything about it, right?
Well, so I that's that you're a flat fee too, and that's a good absolutely. That's a good way to do things. So definitely we'll spread the word on that. And I do appreciate. I think you made that point very well about the difference between student debt and the other debt. You know, I still think it's very important to kind of to look at the options and make sure, because I think that's a good thing to think about and discuss, because I think that the psychological component really does work both ways on the back end of that on that too. And so that's why I think and looking at the tax savings, and you know, there's more to it than just than that. But anywho, this has been fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, Travis. Thank you, man. Thanks so much. Everybody, work smarter, not harder.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.